Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, presented by Paul Spain and Anne Guest.
Welcome along to episode 113 of the New Zealand Tech Podcast. I'm Paul Spain.
Nate Dunn.
Brett Roberts.
Welcome along, guys.
Thanks. Good to be back.
It's good to be back.
Now, Telecom have remained in the media for another week.
Just a few little
with their dramas with their email service, which Yahoo provides for them,
which they said they'd fixed. Well, Yahoo said it that fixed, and it's sort of not fixed. It's still ongoing, and yeah, it's, I don't know why it's taking so long. Is this a Yahoo issue? Or is this a Telecom issue? What? Where's the chain broken down?
Oh, I think it's a Yahoo issue.
It is, but it becomes a Telecom issue very quickly, doesn't it? When it's the Telecom customers that are being impacted. The interesting thing here is that Yahoo have actually been pretty quiet about the whole thing. I contacted them over the weekend for a statement, sent them some questions, and instead of sort of a direct reply back, I got what basically was a new press release from them. Instead of a sort of a direct response, it wasn't particularly helpful. One of the questions I asked is, "Well, where was this? You know, where was this attack coming from?" Because obviously, you know, they would know a lot of information, or they should know about exactly what's going on. Where's it coming from? Who's impacted? Who are the people that have been breaching their security? But they've stayed very, very quiet on that, and they've released really only a very small amount of information. And at this stage, I think this is not good for their credibility, and it's very strange that they're not actually in a position, or they're not willing to front up and to be clear with what's actually happened. Because we're talking tens of thousands of accounts that are compromised. The last number I had Sunday was 80,000. I've seen some other figures, although not directly from them or Telecom, since suggesting even higher. It's not a good look.
They're caught between a rock and a hard place, right? So, you know, obviously they've got a contractual commercial relationship with with Telecom. Everything's fallen over in a screaming heap. They're an American corporate. You know, first rule of American corporates is A, never admit liability, and B, never say you're sorry. Literally, you know, it's because you can get hauled into court for such things. They'll be frantically scrabbling around in the background trying to sort it all out. So they've got technical issues to juggle on one hand, PR issues to juggle on another, and with their third hand, they've got this commercial relationship that they don't want to screw up with Telecom. And I'd hate to be whoever it is that's in the middle of that at a Yahoo, at the Yahoo end. That would be horrible. The thing that I find strange is more that I would have personally expected that Telecom would front with, I don't know, if it's still going and it's still live and it's still an issue, maybe twice a day updates about what's happening or where it's coming from. Chris Quinn, I've got a lot of time for. I think he's done a lot of good work around putting a really, more open face on Telecom. You know, he's on Twitter. He's quite an easy guy to get hold of. This is a big thing for him as well. So I think there's so many things to juggle on this, the technical aspect, the commercial aspect, the PR aspect. So I'm pleased I don't work in either of those organisations. Excellent.
Yeah, well, I actually had a chat to Chris last week about coming on the podcast, and he's more than happy to come on.
Yep.
It's not something that we'll have him on in the midst of this thing. I want to hear a little bit, more broadly around Telecom matters. But maybe once the dust is settled, we'll be able to hear a little bit more about what went on. But at the moment, I guess we're still in the midst of dramas and stresses with a whole lot of account passwords being reset, so people being locked out of email over the weekend and so on. So I guess I'm just hopeful that this sort of settles down a little bit, and that it has the impact of maybe encouraging more people to move away from using their ISP email, which I don't think is a very smart thing to do. It's a convenient thing to do, and I guess it's always a challenge to move away, but maybe this will be encouragement for people to take that difficult step of changing the email address that maybe they've had for 10 years to something else.
If they can log back in and send a thing to their friend saying they've changed.
Yeah.
The thing that's interesting though is I don't see people marching in the streets. It's not like there's thousands of people shrieking about this, you know what I mean? It just maybe goes to show that as you and I were talking about earlier, that there's probably a hell of a lot of accounts that have been compromised that actually people just don't use anymore.
Yeah, I would definitely think that that's part of it. And in fact, I put out a tweet over the weekend, you know, just to see if, you know, what sort of response that there was from people impacted, you know, directly before I did the first line slot with TV3 on Monday morning. And yeah, interestingly, there were a few people that were retweeting my question about there being, you know, asking what issues people were getting, but I don't recall any response, any sort of direct responses on that to people saying, yes, this is how it's impacted me. So yeah, although it's extremely embarrassing and everyone's had a lot of spam and so on, people aren't necessarily sort of feeling, you know, feeling all of the pain. But I think you know, there's something a little deeper that you know, concern about you know, having your data compromised, I think, is something that's pretty pretty worrying to people.
So I think the thing we've learned is it's probably an inverse correlation between people that use Twitter and people that use Extra.
Yeah, true.
Extra email, anyway.
I was impressed with the... Because you normally, when you read about these things, you're either in sort of the group where you see it and get affected, or you're not. And it was, I think it was a Sunday morning, I got the first email through from it was an old Trade Me contact, actually, because I thought, this is strange. And used Google to find them. And then another one came in, and I had probably 20 or 30 that day. And I thought, hold on. And that's
when I realized something was up.
But it was all these random, and they all seemed to be Trade Me contacts. It wasn't really anyone that I'd spoken to lately. But it was all like people right out of the woodworks that I hadn't spoken to for many, many years, but had done a trade with them, that were sending me all these spam emails.
That's really interesting. I mean, I've got three email accounts that I use regularly, a single spam message in Hotmail, my company, or my own company's email, not a single one.
That's fascinating, because yeah. I definitely saw a bunch when this thing first hit. But you know, one of the concerns on an ongoing basis is that if you know these, as we understand that, you know, these contact lists have been compromised, then you know, potentially somebody you know will email you, or it will look like they're emailing you a month or a year or wherever down in the track in the future, and maybe they collate a little bit more information and send you an email that looks very, very real, that, oh, yes, that's from this person. Yep, here it goes. This is to Brett from, you know, someone you know, and it's, you know, been done in such a slick way that that you click through on the link when you shouldn't those sort of attacks.
And so, the amazing thing was the exploit cost someone $700. Isn't that amazing? Apparently that's what it sold for.
Oh, really? Exploit. Okay, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
So it's not very expensive to do these things these days, is it?
Well, it actually raises an interesting point around do Yahoo have a bug bounty program? You know, Google do, a number of the other vendors out there do. It'd be interesting to find out if they actually do anything like that. Could have been the best $700 they ever spent.
Yes. Oh, well. Now, it's funny. There's another drama this week, and this is unusual because we haven't sort of talked about major outages and whatnot in a while, but... IBM launched with a fair bit of hoopla just under 2 years ago now, I think, their new data center on Auckland's North Shore, I think, Highbrook. $80 million was the number that was touted as being invested in launching this new data center to provide cloud services into the New Zealand market. And they've had some nasty dramas this week.
Yeah, it's pretty ugly, isn't it? You know, $80 million, I was thinking as I was driving over here earlier, you know, it's the next marketing campaign could be, you know, IBM data center aiming for 5/8 reliability. Could be quite catchy, yeah. But, I mean, you know, 30, 40-something hours now of outage, but not just that. As far as I've seen so far, no really clear explanation about what the problem is.
No, there hasn't been a clear communication. There was an initial issue, and then they've said that, you know, they've been hit with a second issue.
Yeah, a technical problem.
On top of that, yeah.
But really without
explaining what it is. Now, this is the data center that, you know, we understand they've got something like 60,000 litres of fuel. So if there's a, you know, power issue, that they can keep it running for 3 days standalone. If there's, you know, an interruption to power service. And I think two roofs so that if I guess the first one has an issue, that the next, that it's not going to directly leak. So they've got all sorts of protection, but it looks like they haven't really handled the technical side very well.
Yeah, well, I mean, it'll be interesting to if we get to see the post-mortem and what the cause is. But, I mean, it's a pretty competitive market. There's some really good players out there already. IBM were quite late to that space here in New Zealand. This must be hurting them. I have to say I've now crossed their data centre off my zombie apocalypse list.
I think
there's much better places to start.
I think you wouldn't be the only one.
I think probably most would have done after this. Now, their smart thing would be to come back afterwards and show off what they've learned and what they've done and so on. I don't know whether they're the sort of corporation that would do that. My pick is the smartest thing, and this is, maybe a bit harsh, but if we look at the realities of it, and, we've heard that it hasn't been a particularly well-utilized, data center since its launch. Now, that could be wrong. Maybe it's bustling with customers, but we're not hearing from thousands of customers about the pain this is causing them. My pick is that this might be a data center that in a year or two someone could pick up for a reasonably good price.
Are you shopping, Paul? You're just throwing it out there?
I don't know.
Is it fair to say this is quite a unique event? Like, when you've got servers sitting in a data center, you would have an outage of, say, your rack because something fails, or your network card fails or a power supply fails. So it's isolated to your rack of equipment. But to have the whole data center just click offline.
Dark. It's fairly unheard of. And being so big, I guess that's why I somewhat sort of tongue-in-cheek talk about them selling it. But, if everyone loses confidence in their ability to deliver, not only are they going to lose their existing customers, but, as Brett says about, crossing them off the list, who's going to, who are their customers going to be in the future?
Yeah, I mean, that whole data center space is quite interesting. There's a small number of very good players here in New Zealand already, and it's not hard for them to expand. And I would imagine if the customers in this data center whose servers aren't going now aren't picking the phone up and calling them, the reverse will be happening. Absolutely. The data center is all about reliability. That's the primary thing, right? It's a bit like airlines are all about safety. If you compromise that, you have nothing. And wow. And as far as I've seen, there hasn't been any explanation. So just even fronting the media and saying, oops, we put a backhoe through the main power cable and whatever. But there's been, as far as I know, nothing. Which is an odd stance to take PR-wise.
I'm sure
they're communicating with their customers.
An odd stance from IBM. Like, you'd expect, or I would expect this from, a smaller player, sort of head in the sand, but from IBM, sort of what I would think was a global superpower in IT, to have them just go, I'm not sure, and we're not going to make any comment sort of thing, is, I think, very strange.
See, never apologise, American corporate.
there we are. All right, now, moving along to more fascinating and positive stories, Microsoft Surface Pro launch. Now, that took place in the US just over a week ago, and in the last couple of days or so, we've managed to lay our hands on one of those first units. Brett, now you've been using a Microsoft Surface RT for a little while, running the Windows RT sort of operating system, a little bit slimmer and so on than the full-blown Surface Pro, but we're talking about a device here that basically a full-blown in terms of grunt PC, but in that sort of tablet form factor with the keyboard that you can tack onto it and so on. What are your thoughts from just having a little play with it?
So I like it. I love my Surface RT. It's a really good device. It's the right weight and feels good, and it's got that cool hinge that makes that cool sound. And then just picking up the Surface Pro before, it's a full-blown laptop. The keyboard, the real keyboard, real-ish keyboard, feels really good. It's got enough travel in it that it's really useful.
The type cover.
Yeah, type cover. Really nice device. Next laptop I buy, or next device I buy, I think it'll be one of those. It's kind of got all the bits and pieces right. It's not an ultrabook, and it's not a tablet per se. It's just somewhere in that middle space, which is interesting. It's not that heavy, you know.
Yeah, what's your thoughts, Nate? Because you need a pretty grunty machine sort of on your desk, but you're quite a big tablet user too. What tablet do you normally use at the moment?
I did have the Samsung Galaxy Tab, but I've found, because we're doing quite a bit of travel overseas now, and when I was in the States for 10 days, it was great on the plane, but not very practical for doing any work, and especially with the really cheap Wi-Fi that all the planes have over there, it's actually really nice to be able to kill time by doing work on the plane. So this is a cool, I was just looking at the specs, it's 4 gigs of RAM, of memory, 120 gig solid state drive. Is it
128?
Yeah, 128. What sort of processor on the inside?
It's an i5. I think it's running at 1.7 gigahertz dual core.
It's a cool little, you know. I prefer this, the tactile response of this keyboard as opposed to the just.
Yeah, so you've got the two keyboards. You've got the touch cover, which is what I used previously on the Surface RT, and you've got the type cover. Both have been available with the original Surface, but I thought, well, let's just try this type cover, to see how much better it was. You quite like it.
Yes. And I remember when I first saw the Surface device, I was thinking, well, they're touchscreen, are you going to be using a mouse? But I'm using the keyboard, and it doesn't feel weird at all to be typing and then touchscreen, then type and touchscreen. It doesn't, like, I remember when I first saw it, I thought, well, that's going to be quite stupid because you're constantly moving, but it seems very intuitive to do that.
I think that whole thing, because Steve Jobs came out a few years back and said, you know, no one's ever going to use a touchscreen laptop, and I think he's completely wrong. The minute you have a device where you can just start swiping, it becomes really intuitive really quickly. We bought a one of those HP all-in-one devices, the Windows 7 on it.
Yeah, touchscreen.
Touchscreen. I think only single point touch, put Windows 8 on it. I think it's multi-touch. It just completely changes the way you use the device. You start getting used to just reaching up and tapping on the screen to get to something, and it just becomes natural. In fact, I've got to the point, I've got a Dell XPS 13 in front of me, which is non-touch, but it's got fingerprints all over it, because occasionally something will pop up and I'll go splunk and try and touch it with my finger just to get it going. You know, so I think people get used to it really quickly.
I was sort of quite surprised. And one of the things, I said last week, actually, when we were talking about it, and this had come from my experience with the thinner Surface RT and the touch cover, was that it wasn't something you could use on your lap. But, I mean, Nate, you're using it on your lap now as like in a laptop type form. And how's that working?
Yeah, it's nice and light. I remember when I first got a Dell laptop when I was in uni, and your legs would go to sleep because it was so heavy.
Yeah.
This thing is, yeah, quite comfortably sit here and type on it. It works really well.
Yeah, that was a real surprise to me. And, even when I had the other keyboard on it on TV3 on Monday, and, I was sort of showing off, it doesn't work very well on your laptop. But actually, as soon as I put this keyboard on and put it on my, on my lap, it works okay. It's obviously not as sturdy. You can't pick it up by the base, and so on. But you can actually position it on your knees and work with it okay. There's something about just the extra weight and the solidness of that that type cover that does make that actually practical use. So yeah, in the last couple of days, I've completely changed my view on whether that's the sort of device that I could actually work with, Yeah, I think it is actually potentially a full PC and laptop and tablet type, you know, replacement.
The other thing, you know, to state the incredibly bleeding obvious, is that the thing that gets really hot isn't on your lap. And that's the other thing with a laptop, right? You know, you sit there and they do get warm, and that adds to the discomfort, whereas the bit that gets warm sitting up in the air.
It wasn't so obvious, actually.
I just noticed it then. I just thought I'd say it was obvious, so I didn't look stupid.
Didn't obvious it, and didn't notice it either. So.
No, that's actually a really good point. No, it is a cool device, and there seems to be quite a bit of interest, actually, and something that we've decided at the office, because we had a lot of people wanting to look at these, is we're going to rent them out. So we've already got a couple of customers that are sort of lined up saying, hey, when can we get our hands on one of those? So, it'll be interesting just to see, you know, how many people want to play with them. Hopefully Microsoft will sort out their global distribution issues and work out how to release products simultaneously around the world.
Lack of distribution
issues. And sort that out, because it's somewhat frustrating when a company comes out with a product that you're interested in and then doesn't release it. And, you know, we had the same thing, I guess, with Apple in the early days with the iPhone. And maybe it's just a similar sort of thing where, you know, it's going to take a little while, and then they're going to get to a point of, okay, we're selling this everywhere now, we've worked out whatever, you know, stops us doing that, and we'll just make it available everywhere. And I mean, Apple's now just, you know, phenomenal with that. You know, we're seeing generally pretty good results from Samsung with, you know, global launches of things like the Galaxy S3, although the Note 2 was something we saw, you know, a big delay on. So, you know, we are seeing some, some varying results here, but...
Global logistics must be really hard with something like that, but it's just, you know, and it will take them time just to get into that rhythm, I'm sure, but it is frustrating. You know, I wanted a Surface RT. In the end, a contact of mine brought a whole bunch of them back, 15 or 16, I think, from the States. He asked me if it was okay if it didn't come with a box, because he was just going to stack them all in his suitcase, which is what he did. So... shouldn't have to do that. I have to use a US power adapter. You know, it would just be nice if I could walk into a Dick Smith or a JB Hi-Fi, like you can, I believe, in Australia, and just go and buy one.
Mm. Yeah.
So, but they'll get that stuff sorted out. You know, mind you, they didn't learn a lot from Zune. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, now talking about a competitive product, Google with their Chromebook products. Now, these have been available, I think, 2010. The first Chromebook became available, and now there's a growing list of vendors in the market. HP just announced theirs a couple of weeks ago, 14-inch Chromebook for US $330, and Lenovo, I've got one coming out in the next few days in the US as well, for $429. Now, this is quite a fascinating product, because it takes a very different approach to, you know, really certainly anything that that Microsoft and Apple are doing, and that you've really got a device that, in some ways you can compare to the old sort of dumb terminals. There's not a whole lot of, there's not a whole lot of sort of storage and power that's sort of in the, in these Chromebook little, laptops, because they're leveraging, Google storage in the cloud, what's available online. Any thoughts about these devices? It seems to be, the biggest interest I've heard about is sort of in the education sector. But, you know, what do you think, Nate? Is this the sort of thing that you would find useful?
Not in my day-to-day. I think for education, where you're doing sharing documents, doing collaborative things, it's going to be very, very helpful and very easy to use, because you don't need, you're not going to be a power user, you're not going to need all the features of a desktop. But let's say if you're a designer, where you're going to have the whole suite of products installed, or you're a developer where you need a whole suite of products installed, so you're more of a power user than, say, your average desktop user, it's not going to be very suitable. But I'll use my parents, for example, who don't need all the sort of fancy whiz bang things. They could easily get a Chromebook, and at that sort of price point, it's pretty affordable. And if you were fitting out a whole classroom, that's a lot cheaper than buying everyone iPads or top-of-the-line laptops.
Where do you think that would fit, Brent?
I don't know. I'm intrigued by them. I've been pretty negative on the whole concept. I just think it's a solution looking for a problem to a certain extent. And in some ways, you know, it's a bit like the Ultrabook thing was initially, or the really, you know,
the netbooks.
Interesting, but eventually everything else came down to the same sort of price point.
They became popular because of the price. Yeah, it wasn't that it was actually the best piece of technology.
No, and it wasn't. So, you know, there's always a part of the marketplace that wants to go and buy something cheap, and so it'll appeal. But, you know, I thought your analogy of it being kind of a dumb terminal isn't actually a bad analogy. And I think for a lot of people that want to do anything beyond probably some of the basics, it's going to fail, you know, the sniff test for them pretty quickly. So, you know, will they sell them? Yeah, they will. Will it take off wildly and take over the world? I bet you it won't. It'll just become part of the big, wonderful ecosystem of all the other hardware that's out there, you know. Mm. It's not, I don't. Again, you know, my marching in the streets thing, I don't see people marching in the streets for them. You know, there's a whole bunch of other stuff out there. Schools are using a wide variety of hardware. They're getting far better at the whole bring-your-own-device thing. So kids have got these things at home anyway, their own devices at home. Schools are getting smarter about letting them bring their own stuff in. You know, it is, I think, in a lot of ways, for the vast majority, a pretty interesting solution, but I just don't understand quite what the problem is.
Mm, mm. Yeah, I think, as people do more and more online and run less and less sort of local apps, you know, there is a potential for their use. But I guess some of the you know, things that were really the initial, you know, awesome features of, you know, you would just log into this machine and everything would sort of come down. We're now, you know, we've seen, you know, Apple and Microsoft incorporate that type of functionality into their OSs. So you get, I guess, you know, the benefits of a full-blown operating system, and, you know, you don't have so many constraints, but you also get some of the benefits that were, you know, originally sort of touted as being the, you know, the awesome things of the Chromebook. So I think it's an interesting space to watch, and the fact that HP and Lenovo are jumping on board suggests to me that there must be some growing demand there. So, yeah, I think let's watch the space, see what happens this year with it, because certainly they haven't had much of a market share to date. But I think there's some interesting things Google could do, and you know, maybe some sort of merger of the capabilities of Android into what the Chromebook does. So you've then got maybe more powerful applications, maybe bringing touchscreen and so on board. You might not have so much of that lower price point, but I think it might be attractive to to an audience.
I think that's an interesting point. You know, as a device today, I'm not convinced. As a stepping stone to something more interesting, yeah, could very well be. Mm. There's a great quote on the Wikipedia page for Chromebook, which I think damns it with faint praise. It says, in October 2012, Simon Phipps, writing in InfoWorld, said, quote, "The Chromebook line is probably the most successful Linux desktop/laptop computer we've seen to date." Wow.
That's fascinating, isn't it? I guess, right. Yeah. I mean, Linux has just really, really struggled at that desktop end. Yeah. Now, something that I guess sort of fits in, you know, in between the story about new, you know, new PC tablet type devices is what we're seeing with service and support from vendors locally here in New Zealand lately. Now, I've had a couple of experiences, well, a number actually, with Lenovo, because you know, what we found, my experience over the years was, you know, Lenovo, particularly with their ThinkPads, had a really, really solid, robust product that, you know, was probably the best in the industry from a reliability perspective, and then they backed it up with, you know, really outstanding support from IBM. Now, what we found out later last year was that Lenovo have, in the New Zealand and Australian market, and this is the only market they've done it in worldwide, is they've fired IBM as their local support. And it seems to be really hitting them quite badly. In one case, we saw a situation where a repair took, this was a machine with a next day warranty, I think took something in the direction of 2 months to actually get a resolution.
Maybe they're just adding the word "ish," which next day-ish could be a month.
To me is just, I mean, incredible. Now, they seem to have worked through a lot of their initial teething issues, and it's got a whole lot better. But it seems to me, you know, that that's not something that's going to help their brand. And I'm sure they knew that, you know, one of the standout points for Lenovo was that they used IBM, you know, for support rather than just pitching it out to whoever could do it, you know, the cheapest. And I've also had some experiences with HP in the last few weeks with their support. And I've got to say, it wasn't a whole lot better than Lenovo's, interestingly enough, although they actually have their own support team on the ground in New Zealand. So, it seems that, you know, it doesn't necessarily matter who you deal with. You can end up, you know, getting the wrong end of the stick in terms of surface.
I think the most service. Interesting thing in this is that Lenovo fires IBM and then IBM's data center goes dark.
What is it at the start?
Couldn't afford the power bill or something. It's like, oh, yeah. My God, you know? So they could be related. Yeah, I think...
But is this a financial thing? Do you think it's just the pressure of margins are going down and down and down? There's not much money to actually be made out of selling PCs and laptops and so on anymore. So they're looking at, well, where can we cut back? We're now buying our components a little bit cheaper than we were 6 months ago. We now need to cut back in other areas. I mean, can you really cut back in service? Surely that's something that's going to get more expensive over time.
It's really interesting. I mean, I've been lucky, touch leather. when it comes to PC hardware, I've probably had three or four machines fail over the years, and have been in a situation where they've been hot swapped out, working, you know, well, is it Microsoft or something like that. I've had friends that have bought all sorts of different brands, and everyone has a different experience. You can get two people that buy two HP desktop PCs. One will have a wonderful experience when it comes to being fixed up, and one will have a terrible experience. It seems to be the predictability or consistency of service is part of the issue as well. And yeah. I don't know why, and maybe just to flip that around, I have a nephew who a couple of nephews who are great Apple fans, and one of them in particular had a really bad run with a bunch of Apple hardware, and they just kept replacing it. They just swapped it out. He wasn't particularly impressed with the failures, but he was pretty darned impressed with the fact that they would just keep switching the stuff out until it worked. You know, someone somewhere had a big pile of them that they were just taking machines out of and sending them on. And in fact, as an aside, same thing with Kindles. I don't know what number of Kindles he's up to now, but they just keep swapping them out. Every time they fail, they just send him the latest model, happy as heck. You know, so
companies will want to know who he is so they don't sell him any gear. Yeah, well, that keeps happening, right?
Well, he buys a lot of, so the interesting thing is he buys a lot of stuff on Amazon, you know, a lot of downloads, a lot of content. Yeah, so yeah. From their perspective, they're making the money on that. Yeah. So it's worth sending out the device. But you're exactly right. You know, the margins are getting squeezed, you know, and it probably literally at times comes down to individuals. You know, who's the individual that you deal with who could do something that's required to swap out the thing or whatever, or can't be bothered or whatever it is, you know, it's that consistency of experience, I think, that's lacking. If someone could nail that and you always knew you had a consistent experience, even if it wasn't stellar, but at least you knew that, you know, your 2 days actually is-ish and it's more like 7 days, but it's always 7 days. It always gets sorted, but, you know, sometimes it'll be two, sometimes 200, and that's the annoying thing.
And I think part of it, there seems to be something about New Zealand, the size of our market. It's hard for them to, you know, maybe with the population in our bigger cities is not that much. So it can be hard for them to know how much stock to keep. And they often don't seem to get that, you know, get that very right.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Apple, for instance, if you're in Australia, they've got, you know, great, well, they've got on-site service. I can presume that it's great. I guess you only get another opinion if you find out otherwise. But in New Zealand, they haven't had any on-site support, you know, which is a huge frustration because, you know, Apple gear is you know, a lot of it is used in business, and a lot of it for deadline, critical site type of work. And, you know, a small business can't usually afford to keep hot spares of equipment sort of sitting around. You can't call out Apple and get them to come out and sort of fix it, which is not an ideal sort of situation, really.
I think there's another aspect to this too, which is I saw earlier this week, or might have been late last week, that some site in the States had analysed the Surface Pro from a fixability perspective, and it scored, was it 1 out of 5 or 0 out of 5? It didn't do particularly well.
Basically, these smaller devices, where everything's sort of crammed in, they have to replace the whole lot, right?
So that's a really interesting thing when you think about it. You know, laptops, your average laptop, they are fixable. You know, I looked at the HP you're using there, and you can see the screws, you can open it up. Therefore, you know, it's designed to be fixable. Therefore, when it breaks under warranty, someone's going to attempt to fix it. Therefore, there's a whole chain of events that have to happen, and parts and all the other bits and pieces to fix it, and the expertise required and all that sort of thing.
There's not actually much you can do with this one.
Well, no, probably not. But you think about something like an iPad or a Surface. When it breaks, it's broken, and you throw it in the bin and you ship another one out. Now, the logistics around that, I suspect that that's actually a much cheaper thing to do. It sounds horrible from a landfill perspective, but realistically, amount of expertise required, none. It's just about holding stock. It's about, you know, working out pretty quickly if the fault's, you know, a genuine fault. So in some ways, maybe some of that stuff will go away because these things are just consumer disposable devices versus, you know, laptops, which are more complex and are designed to be fixable.
Yeah, I think it probably depends on the price points of the machines. For instance, yeah, with a low-cost device like a Kindle, for instance, right, you'll call up, you'll explain the fault, and they'll say, yeah, that's no good. We'll send you out another one. Now, what I found with the HP, and I mean, this is a fantastic ultrabook. You know, other than those dramas, I'm very happy with the Spectre XT. But you know, what happened was they said, well, once I'd gone through it, and they said, yeah, we agree that it seems pretty clear what the issue is. Oh, but we do need to send somebody on site to verify it. And I said, well, it's an intermittent issue. You know, it might take a while to actually find it. But you know, fortunately, we were able to see the issue within 5 minutes or so of the technician being there. But that's, you know, an extra step that I guess they have to put in with, if you're talking sort of multi-thousand-dollar hardware, as opposed to something that's, you know, maybe a, you know, one or 200.
Well, there's two things there, right? They can either have the guy stay on site until it fails again, or when they hang the phone up, you belt it against the desk a couple of times to make sure that when he turns up, it's not going to work.
It's 100 broken.
That's right.
All right, I'll remember that tip. Yeah. Thanks for that, Brett.
I'm here to help.
Yep. Now, last sort of, I guess, man, we're really covering some harsh topics this week, aren't we? The last one was one we talked about in the part last week was some of the issues around iOS 6.1. And I said, look, I haven't seen any of these issues. Well, surprise, surprise, over the weekend, I found the battery was running down very quickly on my iPhone. I don't know if that was iOS 6.1 related or it was an app that I was running that was hogging the juice. But, yeah, I sort of really was shocked with how quickly the battery ran out. I was having to plug it back in every 5 minutes. So I've rebooted a couple of times since, and today it actually seems to be reasonably okay. Yesterday I found 10% of the battery dropped through in about 30 minutes while I was driving, so it wasn't getting a whole lot of use, but the battery was diving quickly. So, yeah, but word is that there'll be a 6.1.2 update out from Apple very shortly. So, but at this stage, if anyone hasn't got iOS 6.1 on their iPhone or iPad, recommended that you stay well clear of 6.1 for another few days. And there are a number of people that have come out and sort of said, look, don't use it, don't connect it to your Exchange server, I think is what Microsoft have been saying. So yeah, a few warnings about this release. Still not clear whether all of the issues are Apple's or whether Microsoft's at fault with some issue with the Exchange and the way the two talk together, but just something to be cautious of anyway.
Well, the thing that interests me is, so this isn't the first time that a, you know, phone update's come out and had battery draining problems, but who does the testing? Is there not someone that goes, oh, you know, that problem we had in the past, or we come up with some way of making sure we don't have that again in the future? You know, my, and I've got nothing to back this up statistically, but my sense is that the quality of updates pushed out, and let's say by Apple, because, you know, they get a bit more visible airtime just because of market share, hasn't improved markedly of late. You know, they must, I mean, what happens when one of these things goes out and starts draining batteries? I'd love to be a fly on the wall in Apple.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And I guess Apple are the, you know, are the are certainly the best with rolling these things out quickly. You know, they're able to get them out to devices very quickly, and they also make them available to developers early. So they, you know, they end up with a kind of, I guess, an audience to test it for them. More of an issue, I think, is the other vendors other than Apple rolling them out, because let's say we get a dodgy release from Microsoft with Windows Phone, and there have been, you know, some issues with some of the Windows Phone software in the last little while. You know, it can take them two or 3 months to get something out to their users because of the way in which they do it. As much of an issue for Apple because they're able to fix it quickly. But I think it's a fair point that maybe the testing isn't quite as robust as it should be.
And I guess part of the thing is, and this might sound cynical, but it's practical, that in some ways they're testing against that massive hundreds of millions audience. You know, you roll something out, and if it does break, you know that you can roll a fix out really quickly. I mean, Microsoft can do that on the Windows platform on full size machines. You know, they've got an incredible system. I don't know if you've ever seen how it works, you know, with the picking up the bugs, triaging them, working out what the problem is. I remember being told a great story when I worked there about how one of the video card manufacturers had updated a driver. That update started crashing certain machines with certain configurations or whatever. It took people in Redmond like two or three hours to figure that out. They went back to the video card manufacturer, pointed out the problem to them, fixed the bug, and rolled it out via Windows Update all in the space of like 24 hours.
That's impressive, which is
really impressive, right? And Apple's probably in that same situation. They've got so many devices out there. They've got so many that are monitored from the point of view of pushing stuff, information back. They've got an incredible distribution network. Maybe you don't need to do that level of testing, because the minute a bug pops up, it's pretty obvious. You fix it, you roll it out, another update,
All right, now, lastly, new gadgets coming through. Of course, one of the biggest sort of events for the year in the mobile world, other than CES, where there's usually a few announcements. We didn't have a lot in the mobile space this year, other than the Sony Xperia Z, which is a pretty cool looking Android smartphone. But we've got at Mobile World Congress, we're expecting there to be a few announcements this time around. One we've heard about already is this LG Optimus G, which is a 5.5-inch screen Android handset. Now, this seems to follow Sony's announcement in that it's also got a full HD screen. So, I mean, we're talking the same screen as the same number of... dots or pixels on the screen as your, for instance, your 60-inch TV at home sitting in this little smartphone.
Are you going to be able to notice the HD in such a smaller screen? I can't notice it having gone from a 46-inch non-HD panel to a full 55-inch HD panel. Very, very obvious. As soon as you turn it on, you can see that just everything's amazing. Are you going to be able to? Is that sort of? You're going to get that same thing in such a small form factor?
I think I've got VGA eyes.
My eyesight's not that brilliant, and I think it depends what you're looking at. I mean, for video, not necessarily, but maybe things will just standardize and everything will be running at that same resolution. It might make life a little bit easier. We're not chopping and changing between resolutions. Technically, it might make it a little bit easier for. Manufacturers and software vendors and so on, if everything just ran at the same resolution.
Yeah,
but whether that will happen, I guess there's always going to be, they always want to one up another vendor by doing something. But yeah, we're now talking 440 pixels per inch that we're seeing on this new device from LG. And I think it was Apple was saying that the Retina display, which is a fair chunk lower than that, yeah. That's all that your eye can really perceive. We are getting to a point where it's somewhat pointless to add more detail to the screen unless you're holding it right up to your face. But this looks like a fascinating device. That 5.5-inch screen sort of brings it. I guess as a competitor to Samsung's, Galaxy Note 2, being a large sort of form factor device like that. It's got a big chunky battery, which is over 3,000 milliamp hours, which is, I guess, about 50% bigger than your typical smartphone, battery. If we look at the Galaxy S3, for instance, that's around 2100. There are others, in that sort of 21 to 2300 sort of range. But yeah, your lower end smartphones are often sort of probably about half that 3100 milliamp hour battery. So you should get some reasonable battery life out of that.
To see what with that big HD. Also, the HD panel or the screen on the phone, what it actually does to battery life. Whether they've had to put in a bigger battery because it's a bit of a power hog.
Maybe that's part of it. The other thing it's got is a 13 megapixel camera.
Wow.
Which to me is sort of fascinating. I think we're seeing a similar resolution in the Xperia Z from Sony. I wonder. Can the lens? Such a small lens. Do justice to that sort of resolution. My pick is you're now moving into a realm where it's 13 megapixel just so that it sounds better than the previous devices. Not that there's actually necessarily a big, or even any benefit of having a 13 megapixel, in the same way it would be if we had a 4K resolution screen in a smartphone, that would really be pointless from what you would actually be able to see.
I think there's a couple of interesting things in this. One is I've just discovered that the Xperia is waterproof. That's pretty cool.
It is cool.
But the other thing is just the innovation that's going on in the space at the moment is incredible. If 2 years ago, so how long has the iPhone been out? 7 years? Six, 7 years? If 2 or 3 years ago someone came to you and said, a couple of years' time, Apple are going to kind of be on the ropes. There's going to be a whole bunch of stuff happening in the space. Samsung will, charge through. People would have laughed you out of the room, right? And it just amazes me consistently in this in the technical world, nothing ever stays constant. Whoever's at the front of the race one day is very rarely at the front of the race 5 years down the track, you know, and it's a really, you know, and the beneficiaries out of this are consumers, right?
It just gets
better
and
better and better, you know, huge amounts of innovation going on, which I think is a really wonderful thing, you know, and just to see these new players come in are quite, you know, I think is a really cool thing, you know. So, you know, the more of that, the better. So it'd be interesting to see, I might see what Apple do, because they need a rabbit out of the hat. And, you know, iOS looks tired now compared to a lot of the other stuff that's happening in that space. And you know, they are good at pulling big rabbits out of hats. So it'll be really interesting to see what they do, you know, with iOS 7 or 7.5 or 8 or something.
Well, it's just such a, you know, it's such an exciting space at the moment. And a lot of the innovation's coming with Android devices, isn't it? I mean, that's where, I guess that's where the market share is. That's where, you know, money is actually being made by people other than Apple. And, you know, it's great to see this. I mean, Samsung have been doing so strongly in the Android space. But, yeah, these last couple of announcements, you know, are from vendors other than Apple. Other than Samsung. You know, we've heard from LG and from Sony. So, you know, I think it'll be fascinating to see what Samsung have got up their sleeves for their next couple of releases. The software keeps getting better.
Did Google make any money out of Android?
I guess that they make their money in that they're selling apps and that they're putting their search engine on mobile devices than somebody else's. Yeah. They control that. So, you know, I think it's an important space for them to be in. And, yeah, I'm sure in the long run they're probably doing rather nicely. Thank you very much.
They've done an amazing job. Absolutely.
All right, well, that probably wraps us up for this week. Now, Nate, we can find you on Twitter, at Nate.
Very nice and short.
And you keep a blog online?
Yeah, I feel a bit bad because I haven't blogged for ages. I've just been so busy. I've got lots of stuff I want to blog about, but I haven't. So my blog sits on GeekZone, or you can get to it through my name, natedunn.com.
Excellent. And Brett, you're easy to find on Twitter as well, aren't you?
Because I use my name as my Twitter handle. So Brett Roberts, at Brett Roberts, is me on Twitter. And I used to blog, but I don't anymore. But I write a regular column for Unlimited magazine, so feel free to buy the last paper version of that that's out there, or look for the digital version that has launched. Was it last week or the week before?
So. Yeah, I think that's either just launched or about to launch. Now, something we actually sort of ran out of time to chat about earlier is some stuff, you know, Pitney Bowes, where you're based. You're doing some smarts stuff with some lockers, so I hope we can dive into that a little bit next time that we have you on. I guess we've heard from from Amazon about these sort of smart lockers where you can get things sent to. Can you give us a quick rundown on what these are and how they might be relevant?
Let me see if I can do a real quick pitch. So basically, they're highly secure, solid steel lockers that get dotted around the landscape, and instead of having your latest Amazon/eBay/TradeMe purchase sent to your home address, then you miss the courier and you have to go to the depot somewhere, you get them delivered to a locker that's near, you know, for example, your place of work. The lockers are connected via a cellular data connection to a cloud service. So when your package is delivered, you receive an SMS message and or an email. It has a 6-digit code in it. You walk up to the locker, you punch the 6-digit code in, the door pops open, and you take your new pair of Nike running shoes out, or whatever it might be, shut the door, and the cycle repeats itself.
Yeah, I was quite keen to actually try that out, because I know Amazon are doing it in a number of places in the US, and so when I was there, I was hoping to use it, but I wasn't in the right place at the right time. But I thought, rather than getting stuff shipped to the hotel, and the hotel charges you a big fee for picking up the packages, and you've got to tip them, and all that sort of stuff. If you've got a few packages, it can become quite expensive.
So these things will change the face of logistics. If I give you maybe just a couple of examples. So Amazon are rolling these things out through 7-Eleven stores in the States. The deal with 7-Eleven is it brings in a lot of foot traffic, so 7-Eleven loves that.
Yep.
And Amazon, people can deliver things to them. The next step that Amazon you'll see is preemptive. I call it preemptive logistics. I don't know, I'm sure there's a magical term for it. You imagine being Amazon, they can work out that next week in the Auckland CBD, 7 people are going to want to buy an iPhone 5, 16 gig. So what they'll do is they'll pre-populate a locker in downtown Auckland with those phones. They just put them in there. And when you order them off Amazon, they'll ping you a thing saying downtown Auckland, in the locker. There's one now. Go and pick it up. I mean, that's where
you,
all
you
this
place
stuff
your
is
order, and the goods are there. It's there. They instantly. Know. You yeah. just, you know, you just duck down the stairs or whatever to wherever your latest closest locker is. That they
so
know their stock in.
There's three of these lockers in New Zealand now. There's one at the Wellington Railway Station, one at Botany Town Centre, and there's one at the New Zealand Post Depot, Victoria Street West. They're called parcel pods. New Zealand Post are trialling them at the moment. If you go to nzpost.co.nz/, I think it's parcel pod, not parcel pods, you can sign up and you can, I think, for $5 for 6 months or something, and you can direct as many packages as you like to one of those lockers and try the whole thing out. They work incredibly well. People like them. And so I think, you know, at the moment the trial's going very, very well. They went live early December. And we're talking to them at the moment about what the next steps will be around that. So it's quite exciting, actually. It's a real greenfields opportunity, and there's some quite transformative things in there. There's a number of other businesses and business models that fit into big grey steel boxes that are connected to a cloud service. You know?
Yeah, I mean, there's just always new things coming up that sort of benefit from an internet connection. No, that's cool to hear. All right, well, thank you for that. Thank you for that, Brett. So, yeah, that that wraps us up. You can find me online at Paul Spain on Twitter, or paulspain.com, sort of links through to my my blog and various bits and pieces. And, of course, nztechpodcast.com is where the podcast is, and we're on Facebook, Google Plus, and Twitter. We like to be liked on those sort of channels. So
we all like to be liked.
We do, we do. So, hey, yeah, thanks, everyone, for listening in. We will be back again next week. Hopefully with some more interesting, well, some more positive news, and all of these little outages and things out of the way, and a whole bunch of new technology to talk about. See ya.